Hi, my name is Mandy Jackson Beverly, and I'm a bibliophile. Welcome to the Bookshop Podcast. Each week, I present interviews with independent bookshop owners from around the globe, authors, and specialists in subjects dear to my heart, the environment and social justice. To help the show reach more people, please share it with friends and family and on social media. And remember to subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen to this podcast. You're listening to episode 207. Deborah Crossland teaches English and mythology at her local community college and writes myth-based contemporary novels with a feminist bent for young adults. She is passionate about making education accessible for everyone and lives in Northern California with her husband and her daughter's very spoiled retired service dog. Her recent novel is called The Quiet Part Out Loud. Hi, Deborah, and welcome to the show. It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Let's begin with learning about your interest in mythology and teaching English and mythology.
So I taught high school for about 10 years, and in my first year of teaching, the school that I worked for was great in that they let us work out our own curriculum, and they gave us novels and things like that to work with, and one of them was The Odyssey, and I was brand new. And so I went online to find, you know, lessons and things like that. And I came across Joseph Campbell and the Hero's Journey. And I thought, oh, this is great. This works. And I remembered it sort of from college way back in the 80s, you know. And I showed the kids and they couldn't get enough of it. And so then I was just racing to find as much as I could about it, so I could throw it at them. I teased them. I told them I felt like I was a zookeeper with a chair, you know, just throwing information at them from behind my safe spot. And they were fantastic. They just absorbed it. And of course, that made me gather interest in it as well. And so I set on this, my own journey of trying to find out, you know, where this mythology comes from, all of this. And eventually I landed in Pacifica Graduate Institute, where I was able to get a PhD in mythological studies with an emphasis in depth psychology. And that whole degree, we spent 5 years researching why story is so important to humanity and how to incorporate stories and where to find them and the containers we use for the stories. And along with that, because it's a depth psychology degree as well, we had to do a lot of what we call shadow work and finding out who we are as a person. And boy, was that a journey. I think I came out of that a completely different person, but a much more fully realized person too, which was fantastic.
I can imagine. That's a fabulous course. And for our listeners, Jennifer cut out a little bit here, and she was talking about the mission of Pacifica, which in Latin is Animae Mundi Colende Gratia. Please excuse my Latin pronunciation. But it means tending the soul of and in the world. And for more information, their website is pacifica.edu.
Thank you so much.
Okay, you're talking about their mission.
I took that seriously. And so when I teach now, I still teach in high schools, but I teach college courses in dual enrollment programs so that kids get college credits. And I focus on the care and keeping of their soul as they are working through their senior year of high school and trying to figure out what they're going to do with their life, learning how to write, how to express themselves, how to think critically, all of those things. So we incorporate a lot of mythology in all of my classes. I teach other classes too. I teach women's lit and I teach film as literature, but mythology is at the heart of all of that. And we start classes with a brief meditation, and it's so fun to watch the kids at the beginning. They're all uncomfortable, but by the end of the semester, a lot of times I'll have the same kids the following semester, and they always ask, can we keep doing the meditations? This is the only time of my day that I can take 5 minutes for myself. And it's just really, really cool to watch that happen.
I completely understand where you're going with this, because having taught AP art in high schools and being the parent of high schoolers and college students, the stress on these kids is unbelievable. And in high school, they're trying to do AP classes as early as grade 9. It's just too much, so offering the meditation classes is fabulous. I was in psychoanalysis for about, 10 or 12 years, not every week, and I gained so much from that experience. I found the concepts of Jungian analysis nurtures the creative soul, but it doesn't let you get away with anything either. You kind of are held accountable. And for me, that helped, especially with issues such as imposter syndrome, not feeling good enough, and being creatively stuck in a place, not being able to move forward. There was something you said earlier about the soul.
The care and keeping of the soul?
Yes, I love that phrase. And one aspect of this is, of course, meditation. I've read about schools that are now starting meditation from kindergarten and having it go all the way through high school, which is fabulous. So kudos to you, Deborah, for giving your students meditation moments before class begins.
Yeah, it's great. And one of the things that I differ with Campbell and his hero's journey, as he says that as the hero goes into the belly of the whale or the dark night of the soul, whatever it is, that they have to do it alone. And I understand what he means by that is that the hero has to undertake the journey and do the and commit the actions needed to resurrect again. But I disagree with that because my whole dissertation centered on horizontal relationships, which are friendships and cousins and, you know, social media, all of the things that we can equate with non-authoritative aspects to the relationship. And we take all of that with us when we go down into the belly. We take our friends, you know, the advice, we take the support. And especially, like you said, for creatives, we have to develop some sort of network that keeps us afloat, because you are correct in that imposter syndrome. You know, even after I got the PhD after my name, I still was struggling. And my friend said, you know, please, let's talk about this, you know, and I was like, okay, yes, you're right. But PhD is really just the journey, the beginning of the journey.
Well, congratulations. That's quite a journey in itself. In your acknowledgments, you write how the quiet part out loud started as an examination of the Orpheus and Eurydice myth. Can you expand on this idea?
Sure. So one of the things that my cohort did at Pacifica, we were mostly women. We started out with a few men, but by the time we reached the end of the classes, we were all women. And we were sort of a force. I feel bad for our professors who were more traditional, because we were always like, what about the women? Where are the women's stories? You know, where's the women's point of view? And that sort of followed with the Orpheus and Eurydice myth. I had heard a song during the pandemic. It was called If the World Was Ending, You'd Come Over Right. It was about these two ex-lovers or boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever. And they knew they weren't right for each other. They kept saying that. They'd broken up. Everything was fine. But if the world was ending, they wanted to spend it with each other. And I just became obsessed with that idea. And somehow that got intertwined with the Orpheus and Eurydice myth. And then, of course, I started thinking about Eurydice, and, you know, she has zero agency in her own story. She dies of a snake bite, and she goes down into the underworld, and then here comes Orpheus marching down, coming to get her again. And I thought, what if she wanted to stay there? You know, what if she thought, you know, my life was great, and I had a good time, and I'm comfortable here. Look at, I get to do all this fun stuff, you know, in the underworld, and Orpheus is pulling her out. And I thought I needed to give her a little bit of agency in her own story. So I switched the genders with Mia and Alfie to make Eurydice Alfie. Then I also thought about what happened right as they were about to re-enter the world, when Orpheus turns around and looks back at Eurydice and she's gone. And that's where the story ends. But really, and I had a lot of people die during the pandemic. I lost my dad, my stepmom, and my grandpa. And I thought, you know, what about Orpheus's grief? And, you know, we don't talk about that. We always end the story at the death. We don't ever see the after effects. And so I wanted to sort of poke around at that too.
Well, first of all, my condolences for your losses.
Yeah, they were all, two of them were 3 days apart. Yeah, it was a lot. Yeah.
Grief and trauma has been a constant during the pandemic, especially for many of us who have lost loved ones and friends. And what concerns me is that we have swept this grief and trauma under the carpet, so to speak, because we've had to get on with life. We've had to get on with day-to-day living and caring for others, caring for ourselves. And this concerns me because we haven't had time to go through the stages of grieving.
I have big thoughts on this. I do. You know, our society is built in a very masculine-oriented way. And I don't mean for men. I mean masculine energies, in that doing, always active, you know, moving and going forward, building better, all of these things. And that's sort of, we embrace that as a culture. But during the pandemic, we all were forced to stop and sit. And we had a lot of ugly things happen. And the feminine energies are ones that sit still and feel and examine. And we, as a society, were forced to do that. And we aren't taught how to do that as a society. And so it just became this big, ugly competition, I guess is a word, between the energies of the feminine and the masculine. And the more dominant one of those energies, you know, the other one's going to rise up out of the shadow. And that's what we're seeing right now, is a lot of that feminine had a chance to come up, and then the shadow side of the masculine is going to try to squish that. And we're seeing a lot of that now. But there is a big movement now where people are realizing, you know, we deserve to be able to be still and to rest and to grieve. And I think that there's going to be a reckoning of that, not in a, I don't mean a big, huge, active way, but it'll start with individuals and it'll move, hopefully spread through society.
Okay, let's get back to your book. On page 263, you write, "The earthquake shook open the part of me I'd sealed away." It's such a perfect line to explain the entire story. The novel is a female coming-of-age story about a young girl battling conflicting emotions and not knowing how to express them without pushing those she loves away. Was this part of the story personal to you? And if so, was it healing to write me a story?
Yeah, this story in a way was healing. It was sort of a reflection of what I'd been through in the last 5 years going through the MYTH program. I was raised by a second wave feminist in the 70s who battled the front lines, you know, wore the shoulder pads, you know, just and really took on that masculine persona to beat the patriarchy. And as I was writing, I realized, as much as my mom and her generation did, they were still trapped within the confines of patriarchy, right? They were like goldfish swimming in the patriarchal waters. You know, no matter what they did, they were still in it. And they found maybe the edge of, or the glass on the aquarium, but you know, they were still in there. And I was never really allowed, because of all of that masculine energy, and because my mom was such a go-to it, you know, every time she even saw a woman, a road worker, she'd honk and cheer and "you get him, girl," you know, kind of energy. And so sitting with emotions really wasn't part of my growing up experience. And I mean, I did it on my own, but I didn't really have the guidance. I wasn't given the vocabulary to talk about it. And Mia feels a lot like me in that way, because, you know, she's raised in this family that abides by strict religious rules, and she's not allowed to be a person outside of what is expected within her role in the family and in the church. And she didn't have the vocabulary to talk about it. And so, of course, she has, you know, panic attacks and you know, anxiety over this. And I've seen a couple reviews where people talk about Mia as being unlikable. And that's what happens when women aren't given the chance to express themselves in a way that they can really examine who they are. If they're not given the vocabulary, it comes out as angry, or people receive it as being angry, because they don't really know how to express themselves. And so, yeah, I think in a lot of ways, watching Mia have a personal earthquake, as well as the one in the story, was very much reflective of what happened to me in the last 5-6 years. Yeah.
I found that I have to be careful when I use the word feminist or feminism, because I want there to be equal pay for men and women. I support equality of the sexes, but I don't feel the need to be tougher than I am. I want my voice heard, but I'm certainly not going to knock anyone down in the process of being heard. I'd rather lift others up. I'm not willing to give up my femininity and my need to nurture all things feminine because I'm a feminist. My mother was a feminist in Australia. She was a nurse who worked and fought all her life for equal pay for nurses. So like you, equality was ingrained in me since birth. I believe that the strength of a woman is to be able to hold others up. It's about being supportive of one another. And it's also about nurturing the journey of femininity. As a 64-year-old woman, I can now say that I have a deeper understanding of what it is to be female and a feminist than I did at any other stage in my life. I find it fascinating, to be quite honest. What are your thoughts on this? Do you agree?
Absolutely. Oh, no, 100%. And I think this third wave of feminism is exploring the permission to still be feminine and to still have that power. And it's a quiet power and something that I've tapped into as well. And I've noticed it in my relationships or my interactions with people on the street. You know, I'm still who I am and I will be graceful and I will be, you know, nurturing and loving, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to lay down, right? And it is a journey to find that within yourself, to be able to express that and to hold that. And to look at a person that maybe might have angered you or made you feel insecure before, and to be able to acknowledge their strengths and walk away from their weaknesses or what you perceive as a threat maybe, or project onto them your weaknesses. Someone said to me once, and I tell my students this all the time, that when you see people that you just don't like for some reason, you can't put your finger on it, they never really did anything to you, you just don't like them, it's because you're seeing something about yourself that you don't like or you're not comfortable with within them. And that's so humbling because you have to stop and think, what is it about myself that I'm putting onto this person, and examine who you are. And in that way, it is very much a journey. Dennis Slattery is a professor emeritus at Pacifica, and he has a ton of books out. And one of the things that he says is it's not really so much as a circular journey, but a spiral, because we move around and we go on this journey, but then we start again in a slightly different position, and then we do it again, and then we do it again. And so I think that's a great metaphor.
Yes, it is a good metaphor. I do want to say one thing, though. I really root for the women who are out there, the strong women speaking for us as feminists.
Oh, yes.
Now, I would love to hear your story from your first finished manuscript to landing an agent and a publishing deal.
Okay. So I wrote this book really, really quickly. It sort of just kind of poured out of me. And I know you hear that when people say, it just poured out of me. This one did. It had a different energy as I was writing it. And I finished it in December and I started querying it in January. And one of my very experienced writing friends said, no, you can't do that. That's not how it's done. You have to revise. You have to think about it. I was like, no, this is pretty done. Like I have a good feeling about this. Mind you, I was in the middle of writing my dissertation when I wrote this book. I put my dissertation down for this. And thank you to my critique partner, Dante, who was like, you better write this. I'm not going to be your friend anymore if you don't write this. And so I did. And I started querying and I got some attention. I got some requests right away. I got some really good feedback. I had an agent who was very interested in it, gave me a chance to rewrite a little bit of the beginning. And funny enough, the chapters never changed. The starting point never changed. It was just sort of smoothing it out a bit, I guess. And we got close, but then she just said, no, I don't think it's quite right for me, which is fine. You know, I've been in the business long enough that I don't take that stuff personally anymore. And I queried wide. Because it's a YA contemporary, it's very difficult to get those placed. You know, it's easier for fantasies, not saying it's easy, but it's easier for fantasy to find a niche, that sort of thing. And so I knew to query wide and to query, you know, for a long time. So I kept going and I got to the 75th agent and I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. I need to stop. And I wanted, my goal was to query 100 agents with the book. And I was just like, this is getting tiresome. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe the energy was wrong. And I just was projecting something onto this book. And I was searching Publishers Weekly or Publishers Marketplace or something. And I came across my agent's name, Molly's name. And I thought, there's no way. I thought, this will just be my last one. And I'll just, this will be a great way to end, because there's no way she's going to look at my book and say, I want to read this. And so I sent her a query. And later that week, she was like, hey, I want to read the full. Don't do anything until I read this. And I was like, no, this is not happening. And so I did. And she emailed me in the middle, like the weekend. She's like, I'm halfway through. You know, this is great. I'll be in touch next week. And so immediately I ran to my computer and opened my manuscript and went to the halfway part to see where, if I could figure out where she was reading, which is so stupid. And so I waited, and she emailed me and set up a phone call, and I was freaking out. And I had another agent offer as well at the same time. And I had queried the other agent several times with other projects. And she was like, we finally can work together. This will be so great. And she was fantastic. And it was a struggle, because I had sort of a loyalty to the other agent that I'd worked with and queried before. But I couldn't say no to Molly. She's just such a great agent. And she has so many great deals and such good contacts. And I said, okay, I have to go with Molly. And boy, am I ever glad I did. So.
And that's Molly Click, right?
Yes, yes. And we revised once, and then it was sold. It sold in about a month after she put it out there. And then, of course, we revised another time with the editor. And then now it's out in the world.
Are you working on another novel?
I did submit a proposal for my book too. I haven't heard anything back yet, but it is sort of the same way this, that The Quiet Part Out Loud is about Orpheus and Eurydice. This book, this new book, is about Psyche and Eros, but it's still contemporary. You probably could read it without the mythological background and still see the, hopefully have a good story.
And what draws you to the YA genre?
I think just the experience, everything as a teenager, you know, you experience everything for the first time. Everything is much bigger and more dramatic. It's just a really interesting time in a person's life to see the world open up and not really have the tools or the skills to navigate it. And because I work with teenagers so often and I get to see them in real life go through these things, it's very motivational to keep in that field. I do eventually want to write in the adult market, but YA, I think, is going to always have my heart.
It sure is interesting, isn't it, working with teenagers? It can be mind-blowing, because everything you read about teens is kind of true. And I think that's why they need books that they can relate to, so that they know they're not alone, so that they know what they're doing is normal and what they're going through is normal.
Yes. Yeah, that's the big thing, is everyone is so concerned that they're going to be weird or people are going to think they're weird. And, you know, I live in a very diverse city. They've said that it's the most diverse city in America.
Are you in Northern California?
Yeah, just outside of San Francisco. Yeah. And, you know, it's so important to for kids to be able to see themselves in books, like you were saying, culturally too, you know, not just personality or insecurities and things like that, or love interests, but things that validate people and who they are and give them the confidence to continue on that path.
I've spoken with over 100 indie bookshop owners over the last couple of years, and we've all agreed on the importance for anybody walking into a bookshop that they can see themselves on the shelves of the bookshop, from picture books, early readers, all the way up through to adult reading. And I'm not just referring to genres, I'm referring to ethnicity, diversity, and people who may be disabled in some way.
Yeah.
It's important for us all to see ourselves on the shelves in bookshops and libraries and in schools.
Yeah, I think it'll be really nice to be able to say, here are books, instead of saying, here are diverse books mixed in with others. I just can't wait for that vocabulary to change. It'll be great.
Yes, that will be great. Now, getting back to the quiet part out loud, throughout the story, you use different religious beliefs as a way for characters to both reach out to and nurture Mia. However, religion is a slightly dark shadow regarding Mia's mother's affair. Was this in your initial concept, and did you find it difficult to weave into the Orpheus and Eurydice myth?
So again, with the myth background, we did study a lot of religions and, you know, what some people call myths, some people call religions. And so I'll just leave that there. And it was important to me to reflect the diverse backgrounds that I'm surrounded by. Obviously, I need, my experience is as a white person. So my main character needs to be somebody that reflects me. That I feel comfortable writing about, but I wanted to bring in as much diversity as I could. And one of the ways to do that would be to make the supporting cast come from diverse areas. And each character represents a different cultural background or religious background. But I wanted to, just to make it interesting for Mia, because as a writer, you know, we always ask, how can we torture our characters the most? And religion for her is such a touchy subject that I thought, what if her healing came from others' religion and their belief systems? And I thought, ooh, if that were me, that would be a huge hurdle to have to overcome. So I thought, perfect, I'm going to torture her with that. But I, you know, one of the characters, Devi, is based on an Indian goddess. And so she has a lot of, you know, her mythology. And then her best friend, Simi, of course, comes from the Sikh tradition, which is one of the most beautiful expressions of spirituality I think I've ever encountered. And I had a fantastic time writing Simi. I think she's probably my favorite.
Okay, let's talk books. What are you currently reading?
Well, currently, I'm reading a couple of middle grade books for reasons. trying to get a feel of what that market's like. And I'm playing around with an idea for Castor and Pollux adventure. They got a lot of adventure, but they got no fulfillment in their journey. Playing around with that a little bit. I just finished The Renaissance of Gwen Hathaway by Ashley Schumacher, and it's fantastic. She has camel jousting in the book. It takes place at a Renaissance fair, and I was texting her as I was reading it, screaming at her, saying, I hate you for making me laugh, because her books normally make me cry. And I'm like, if you make me laugh this hard now and I have to cry at the end, I'm going to be really mad at you. But she said it was okay. And there was no crying at the end. Yeah, it was hilarious. Yeah, it was adorable. Loved it.
Laughing is great. Laughing is good. Deborah, thank you so much for being a guest on the Bookshop Podcast. Thank you for all you do to support education, to help students, and congratulations again on gaining your PhD and for the publication of The Quiet Part Out Loud.
Oh, thank you so much. That's really kind. And thank you for having me. It's been fun talking with you. I love talking about mythology. I could do it all day.
I'm looking at my bookshelves and thinking we've probably got a lot of the same books. Have you read Women Who Run With the Wolves by Clarissa Pinkola Estes?
I did. Yep. It's on my bookshelf. It's a good one. Yeah. She's an excellent writer.
Yes. That's a good book to have on your nightstand.
Have you read The Heroine's Journey?
By Maureen Murdoch. Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, good. So Maureen was on my chair. She was my internal reader. Yeah, I was very starstruck. So she's very cool. You might look up Christine Downing. She has several books out. Her most popular, I think, is called The Goddesses. But she actually wrote one about menopause and what it means to through a depth psychological lens, which was fantastic. Psyche Sisters is also a really good one that she wrote.
Yeah, in fact, there was an anniversary edition, I believe, of The Heroine's Journey, Women's Quest for Wholeness by Maureen Murdoch. And Christine Downing wrote the foreword for that particular edition.
She was my chair, and I just love her to death. Every time I have an issue, I was like, do you have anything on this? She's like, here, read this. It's an essay I wrote in 75 or something. You know?
Well, you were lucky to have her. I believe she's 92. She is an incredible woman. See, once we start talking books, there is no stopping us, but I'd better put the brakes on. Deborah, thank you so much for being a guest on the Bookshop podcast.
Well, thank you so much. This has been fantastic.
You've been listening to my conversation with Deborah Crossland, author of The Quiet Part Out Loud. To find out more about the Bookshop podcast, go to thebookshoppodcast.com. And make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen to the show. You can also follow me at Mandy Jackson Beverly and the Bookshop Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and on YouTube at the Bookshop Podcast. If you have a favorite indie bookshop that you'd like to suggest we have on the podcast, I'd love to hear from you via the contact form at thebookshoppodcast.com. The Bookshop Podcast is written and produced by me, Mandy Jackson Beverly. Theme music provided by Brian Beverly, executive assistant to Mandy, Adrian Ottohan, and graphic design by Francis Farala. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.